Rewind, your week in review, is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.
This week on Rewind, your week in review, the state's high court has ruled in the redistricting battle, giving Governor Evers a victory. Plus, Michael Gableman releases his interim report after spending months investigating the 2020 election. We break down his recommendations and the ones that are receiving swift backlash from both parties. And we'll have the biggest takeaways from the latest Marquette University Law School poll. All this and more on Rewind, your week in review for March 4th.
Hi, I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
J.R., we are starting off the show with your favorite topic,
yes,
redistricting. from the state's high court ruled yesterday, a 4-3, adopting Governor Evers' redistricting maps. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, Evers took this as a big victory. Let's first kind of just talk a lot about a few of the reactions that we heard after this ruling on Thursday. Governor Evers said, "Today's ruling is a victory for me. Isn't a victory for me or any political party, but for the people of our state for too long have demanded better, fairer maps." And then, of course, we had, you know, criticism from Republicans saying that, you know, from Senate Majority Leader Devin Lemieux, that he never had a hearing on these maps. You know, he went around the, you know, basically cut the corners to try to get this done. But I think let's put this into perspective for our viewers here of what map they picked, JR. Mm-hmm. You know, they picked the least change approach, which we talked about a lot of times on this show. But let's kind of remind people what that really means.
Well, I got to say, this was a surprise in some ways. But if you know Brian Hagedorn, it shouldn't have been. And why I say that was the court in November said least change approach to the existing lines, which Republicans approved in 2011. At the time, we thought, okay, the foundation is the Republican maps. Therefore, it's going to be a really good map for Republicans. And it still is. But it's not as good as it could have been, because Brian Hagedorn said, we're going to use a core retention measure about what the least change means. What does that mean? Well, congressional maps, okay? Evers' map moves 324,415 people to new districts. That's 60,000 fewer than the next best map, according to Hagedorn's ruling. With the legislative districts, all right? The Senate districts, almost the same. The core retention is 92.2%, meaning that everybody, the district you're in right now, you stay in it. But the assembly map, Evers' core retention is 85.8%, whereas the Democrat or Republican one was 84.2. Brian used this core retention as the driving principle for what a least change approach was. Now, the three conservatives were up in arms that this was not mentioned in the November order or in Hagedorn's concurring opinion. This is made up, in the words of one of the conservative justices, ripping the decision. But Hagedorn, if you know him, he basically, we said we're going to do this, and we did it. That was the approach that he took in the map. Now, you have to note that the three liberal judges, Ann Walsh Bradley, Rebecca Dallet, and Jill Karofsky, didn't like least change approach in November. They dissented from that ruling. They signed on to Hagedorn's opinion because with the parameter of least change, this was the best option. They also got the map that they wanted, right? Because
right.
They're liberals, and it's Evers' map. The three conservatives unhappy, get the map that they wanted. They wanted the Republican map. So that might be driving some of their unhappiness with what Brian Hagedorn did.
And, of course, you're kind of leading into kind of the next topic I want to touch on is the politics behind this, right? We know Governor wants to take a victory lap with this. And it doesn't look so good for Republicans, in a sense, because they thought they had the upper hand going into court. And another topic we need to touch on, too, is that this legal fight might not be over. We could see this be challenged in federal court.
Yeah, so let's talk about the possible challenges first. There are two possible challenges. One is the deviation from being exactly equal for congressional districts, right? There's a deviation of plus or minus two. I know this sounds like a whole lot, but there's an argument made that it has to be plus or minus one. So there's that question. Will the Supreme Court say that was not appropriate what we did? We'll see. The other thing is Governor Evers' maps include seven majority black assembly districts. The question is, was that justified? Now, remember, the Voting Rights Act says that there are certain circumstances you have to give a minority community the opportunity to elect a candidate of their choice. There's a three-part test the Supreme Court set down when deciding whether to draw districts based on race. One, that the racial group is sufficiently large and geographically compact, all right? Two, it's politically cohesive. And three, the majority votes efficiently as a block to enable it to usually defeat the minority's preferred candidate, i.e. white voters override black voters and elect a white candidate, for example, in a black-white district. The question is Evers' map, is there a justification of the Voting Rights Act to draw seven districts? Don't forget, too, Evers' maps are precise in these seven majority black districts. They are all between 50% and 51.4% black voting age population, with the caveat of it's an expanded definition of black. Traditionally, it's been if you are black or blacker, black and white on your census form, you're considered a black voter. Evers is using if you're black and Hispanic, black and Asian, any black heritage counts toward a black voting age population. I'm not a judge. I can't tell you if the courts will agree with that. But he's using it as a justification for these seven districts. The conservatives say that's an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. These districts were drawn with the race in mind solely, therefore they will not withstand scrutiny. Pat Rogensack wants the U.S. Supreme Court to review this. So you can ask the U.S. Supreme Court to do stuff. You can't force them to, so we'll see how that goes. The interesting thing is the Republican map that the conservatives all thought they would preferred had five black majority districts in the assembly. Annette Ziegler also wrote in her dissenting opinion that while she preferred the legislature's map, she also liked one from the scientists and mathematicians who had three majority black assembly districts. Again, I'm not a judge. I'm not a lawyer. I don't know how three would fly with the federal courts, although Voting Rights Act is a little bit up in the air, a couple of reasons. So there's your possible review. And here's what to keep in mind. Even if the federal courts don't overturn the map, if it stays in place for this fall, the fight is not done because if there is a Republican governor come January and Republicans control both houses of the legislature again, even with these maps, pretty good bet, Republicans have the opportunity to pass their own maps again because this happened in the 1980s. Federal courts drew a map for 82 elections. Democrats had full control in 83. They put a map into the budget. Tony Earle vetoed out of the budget saying, not the appropriate place for a map, and they passed their lines in a standalone bill. Republicans would have that opportunity next year to put the map that was rejected by the court in place come January.
Well, that was going to be my next question. Like, where could we see this in the future? Of course, we're going to see the governor on the campaign trail touting that they selected my maps. But I think what we also need to let people know is that it's not really going to change much or give Democrats any, big headwinds in legislative or congressional districts because it's just very least change approach like how we started this.
But it puts a two-thirds majority just out of reach for Republicans, even in a good Republican year. Why is that important? If Governor Evers were to win in November, and again, we think Republicans should win the majorities with these maps even in place, if there's Evers in place, if you had the Republican map in place, Evers could be irrelevant because if you reach two-thirds majorities in both houses, who cares what Governor Evers does, right? They can override him if they want to. Those are a cohesive unit. Look at these maps. So the governor's Senate map, for example, right? It has 20 GOP seats and 13 Democratic seats. When I say that they're Democratic-Republican seats, what I mean is that these redistricting is a tool a lot of people use if you're a geek like I am about redistricting to gauge the performance of a district. Over time, there are 20 Senate seats that typically vote Republican, 13 that typically vote Democratic, right? The current maps we've had in place last decade, Trump won 22 seats, okay? If you look at the assembly, all right, governor's map has 55 GOP seats, 44 Democratic seats. The existing lines, Trump won 62 of the existing districts. The Republican map, Trump, if they had been in place in 2020, Trump would have won 64 assembly districts. 66 is your key number in the assembly for a two-thirds majority. Other thing to note, Evers' maps pairs three sets of Republican lawmakers. Alberta Darling and Dale Kuyenga in the Senate, Chuck Wickers and Cody Horlacher in the assembly, and Dan Knodel and Barb Dietrich in the assembly. What do they do? Alberta is not up for election this fall. Dale is. So got to watch how that plays out. They're in the same district. In theory, they have to run against each other for the party's nomination. The other four, they'd have to either move. It's another option for Alberta and Dale to move. Mm-hmm. Other four, move or in a primary with each other to stay, have a chance to stay in your seat. So, yeah, it's going to be interesting this fall.
Of course it's going to be interesting this fall, but this just got even more interesting this fall. Another big highlight of the week was retired Supreme Court Justice Michael Gableman released his interim election report. Now, this comes after months of him investigating the 2020 election, and we were promised by right around now we'd see something. So let's first talk about kind of some of the key recommendations that he made when he was testifying to the Assembly Elections Committee. Kind of the big headline that a lot of people and us wrote about this week is that he wants the legislature to take a hard look at decertifying the 2020 election. That is not possible. We've heard from nonpartisan attorneys and even Speaker Voss, who is against that. He also is calling for the legislature to dismantle the Wisconsin Elections Commission. Another thing to note that Assembly Speaker Robin Voss says he doesn't want. And, of course, Voss hired Gableman to do this entire investigation. Some other claims that he made, he called it, quote, in his report, illegal bribery regarding the Center for Tech and Civic Life. Those are those private election grants funded by what also Republicans like to call Zuckerbucks, funded by Facebook CEO, and called it illegal to send absentee ballots to nursing homes. That's been a big section of his report, and also believes drop boxes are not allowed under state law. So let's hear a little bit from Gableman's testimony before we kind of dive into some of these claims and recommendations that he made on Tuesday.
This meeting today is part of an ongoing discussion that will not end today. This is an important topic, and there's a lot of work to do. With that teed up, at this point, I believe the legislature ought to take a very hard look at the option of decertification of the 2020 Wisconsin presidential election.
Are you saying that we should decertify Wisconsin's votes?
Without having the benefit of input from any substantive witness, there appears to me very significant grounds for such an action.
It's not often that Representative Steinicke and I agree on things in general, but we seem to both have the opinion that it's not possible to decertify. So thank you for your time.
I think what Justice Gableman is saying, the action for administration correction, for an administrative correction, it is not a clear path.
So we got this 136-page report right before he began his testimony. So we were sifting through it. We were kind of talking about how there's some parts that were missing in it. But also we heard that he basically said right off the bat that I'm not done. My work is not done. There's a little still confusion that he didn't clarify whether his contract or if there is a contract. He once said that he has a verbal agreement with Voss. Voss has also confirmed that. So a lot of questions still up the air. And it seems like he could also testify again, maybe on a final report, if we can finally call it that, in the near future.
He said he's just getting started. So in the report, it promises another report about indefinitely confined voters. These are voters who are confined due to age, illness, or infirmary. They are allowed to receive absentee ballots automatically for each election and return them without giving a copy of their photo ID to clerks. Use of that exploded during 2020. Also, absentee balloting exploded in 2020, so it's kind of like in line with that. That said, Republicans think there's something off about that, so that's going to be part of what's coming next. The report includes a section on the lengthy number of court cases involved in right now. Those are not going to end anytime soon. He'll be fighting over whether he can interview Megan Wolf from the Elections Commission or Eric Genrich from the Green Bay Mayor's Office, or give me Mayor or Madison Mayor in private versus in front of a Assembly Committee. That's going to be going on. Oh, by the way, Michael Gableman is in the spotlight right now. He has got a ton of attention. He has got a charge before him. He is not going to let this go anytime soon. It keeps Republicans looking back, not looking forward to what could be a great environment for them in 2022 because it's a midterm Democrat in the White House. Now, looking at the report itself, there are some holes, right? For example, Gableman in his report wrote that there were people who are non-citizens who voted in the election in 2020, did not list a single name of somebody who's accusing of doing that. That seemed to be somewhat odd. The video we watched during the hearing of people who are in nursing homes, definitely hard to watch at times, wasn't quite clear if those folks had been declared incompetent by a judge, which is the only that could prevent you from casting a ballot. Now, there are also laws about pressuring people to vote or trying to influence me to vote, that would be an issue if that happened. But we don't know that. We also don't know, for example, he says that there are these nursing homes with 100% turnout. Did they talk to the administrators to find out what they did? Did they have a ballot drive in those nursing homes? Did they take precautions to make sure that the residents were protected, were not influenced? We don't know. It's not in the report. This is an example of Gableman throwing out a lot of allegations without really kind of putting some substance behind it to give us something to go on. The funding for private funding for communities, we've known about that. That's not new. He's just adding more kind of fuel to that fire. And I'm not trying to say that there's nothing wrong here. I've talked to people for months who have said there should be an adult conversation about private funding for public election costs, but there's a lot not quite there that people are kind of like, I want to see more.
And this comes after the state legislature last week took final action on a slew of election bills. So they're trying to move on and get this thing over with, but they have Gableman lingering and still not having his final report or recommendations, because we also heard a few weeks ago that Speaker Voss said session might go longer to incorporate some of Michael Gableman's findings. Well, like you said, there was some holes. So there was, of course, he has some recommendations, but I would say almost the two big ones, Voss is completely against. Mm-hmm. And then the others, issues with nursing homes, election grants, lawmakers already passed legislation to address those issues, even though we know the governor is likely bound to veto all of those.
Republicans are like, if we just stuck to the Zuckerbucks and focused on that, we'd be in great shape. But now that Gableman is talking about decertifying the election results, it overshadows everything. Every story I read about the coverage of the hearing, every TV show, focused on the call to decertify. Even though Gableman, if you notice, said, they took a hard look at it. I'm not saying you should. I'm saying there's a path to do it, although that path is kind of complicated because the Elections Commission is involved in it.
And he goes into detail about this path, and that kind of just leads into our next slide, I should say, is that he got slammed for that from both parties. Yes, several Democratic statements, Governor Evers calling an embarrassment, a circus, et cetera, waste of taxpayer funds. We had outgoing, I should say, Assembly Majority Leader Jim Steinke start doing a series of tweets saying, let me remind you folks that this is not legally possible. Our attorneys have said we can't do this. We don't have a path to decertification. And during my remaining time, I guarantee you I will not take part in any effort to do this. Called it a fool's errand, and let's focus on the future. So another outspoken Republican, I mean, in a sense, he kind of has free rein to, stand up to these type of claims and Gableman because he's not going to be seeking re-election. But just kind of interesting to see kind of both sides get reaction from Gableman on that. One other thing we want to talk on, because you kind of reported on this. It was an email from the Republican Party of Wisconsin, the chair, Paul Farrow, which kind of relates to Voss and election stuff. They sent a letter to local leaders inviting them to meet this month for a legislative update with the state's top two Republican lawmakers. So this basically, it doesn't really directly mention the 2020 election, but in a sense it's addressing the multiple calls and what I've reported on, over a dozen counties now calling for Assembly Speaker Voss to step down. So it seems like the party is going to be taking a hard look at this, and they want to talk and get some things straightened out before heading into the midterms.
I mean, in reading the email, it was clear throughout that they're trying to get everybody back on the same page of looking ahead, not looking behind. And that's why this Gableman thing is so problematic. It adds fuel to the fire of those who are critical of Voss, who think he hasn't done enough on 2020, that he should be trying to overturn the election results, even though Robin has said, not interested. Attorneys have said, can't happen. They still want to see it happen. They are convinced that he's holding back. And it's just an example of where this is a political problem for Republicans to keep having to focus on this question, even though we know it can't happen.
Basically trying to unite the party, even though Voss says he doesn't think they're not united, but this meeting kind of might mean otherwise. Let's quickly, we're running out of time because we got so many topics this week. Let's move on to the Marquette University Law School poll. Just leading out of the elections, I'll talk about this and we'll kind of toss to the next topic, JR. Confidence in the elections was asked. Kind of the biggest point we wanted to point out is that Over two-thirds of people have faith in the election of the outcome, despite Republicans arguing their election bills would restore faith and restore integrity in future elections. So obviously there's a partisan split here with, you know, fewer Republicans have, you know, confidence. A majority of Democrats do. But we did see a slight uptick in Republicans having a little bit more confidence compared to the previous poll. Also, we have head-to-head matchups. Let's first touch on the incumbents. Governor Evers' approval ratings there. Ron Johnson kind of got a majority of the headlines only because his approval rating, or excuse me, favorability, is tapering off. But poll director Charles Franklin says, you know, let's just wait a little bit because a lot of things can change, and do not count him out comparing to what happened when he ran in 2016.
In 2015, Johnson was also significantly underwater on favorable and unfavorable and had what until recently was his lowest net ratings in the second half of 2015. But if you watched him in our data in the spring of 16, those favorable numbers got better and better and better. He was trailing Feingold, but from the midsummer through our last pre-election poll, the margin closed and closed again and closed again, so that by our final pre-election poll, we had it inside the margin of error, Feingold by one, but a toss-up. Johnson ends up winning by just over three. So I'm going to watch very carefully whether we see Johnson start to turn around those favorability numbers when we have living proof that he did it once before and against a very well-known opponent. You know, the Democrat, whoever the nominee ends up being, is certainly going to be not as well-known initially, but then can they build not just recognition but also a platform to really weaken Johnson in the campaign?
So, Darren, no really big surprises because we know we're so far out from the midterms, but a little hot, you know, hot water for Ron Johnson, but, you know, he can always turn things around.
Quickly, Tony Evers, he's had four polls since he took office where he's below 50% for job approval, three in his first year in office, all three of those is in plus territory, and the fourth one was in October. So, good number for him. Probably driven because he is handing out big checks left and right from the ARPA money. He signed a bunch of tax cuts. This poll was taken not long after the State of the State recalled for more tax cuts. And nobody's hitting Tony Evers on the air right now. There's no sustained TV buy statewide going after him. Now it's going to change. There are vulnerabilities. He had a cringeworthy comment on a TV show about being too busy to go see the
crime victims in Milwaukee.
Yep. Yeah. That's going to come back to bite him.
There's already some political ads with Clayfish targeting for not being tough on crime.
But nothing is on the air in a sustained way, and Clayfish and Nichols are talking on social media about Evers. Real people don't look at it. Well, you and I look at it.
Right.
But real people don't see social media. Ron Johnson, one of his troubles is he's soft with Republicans. That's not good. And two, we can't focus on somebody else. He doesn't have an opponent yet. If you are incumbent with bad numbers, the playbook is tear down the other guy or girl. There's nobody to tear down right now because it's a crowded Democratic primary. That's an issue for him. And with Biden, where is he going to be come October? Because where Biden is going to dictate a whole lot how those races are going to go for Senate and governor.
Let's quickly touch on primary candidates. We got the Republicans for governor and U.S. Senate candidates. We've been talking about these two for a very long time as front runners. Rebecca Clayfish, of course, topping the charts with 30% approval. Mandela Barnes with 23%. But I think the interesting part with the U.S. Senate race is that Alex Lazary is in second place. And you also wanted to touch on a separate poll that his campaign did. Of course, he looks good in it. But, you know, he's pretty close to Mandela.
Look, Franklin's poll is great. But in gauging primaries, you're taking a general election. You're actually registered voters trying to narrow down a primary field. Primary voters are pretty darn engaged and active. The campaigns are a little bit better at polling a primary. So when I saw Lazary's poll where he's closed a gap from 43 to 4 in August to like 8 points, like 35-27 in February, okay, that's noteworthy because he spent $3 million bucks plus on TV. The question is, can Lazary get over the hump, right, catch Barnes? Will Galuski spend money to make it a three-person race? But the clear thing is between this poll and Lazary's poll is it's a two-person race right now. Right now, the nomination for U.S. Senate, can Galuski make it a three-person race? Can Nelson make any noise? I don't know. Nelson, by the way, is starting to take some jabs at Mandela Barnes.
I was just going
to
mention that, yeah.
So that's going to be something to watch. Keep an eye on that.
And because we haven't seen too many go after each other. They want to have this central message of let's beat Ron Johnson. And now we're seeing a little shift there. Let's get to stock picks. We only got a few minutes left in this week's show. You have rising this week the 1st and 3rd congressional districts.
So these maps, it makes two competitive seats in our congressional delegation, which we haven't had in a long time.
It's exciting.
Yes. Yes, it is, especially for TV people because
right.
they had revenue.
Oh, yes.
Now, the 1st district, that's been solidly GOP the last decade. Brian Sauer represents it. It's using days redistricting, like looking at historical performance. It's now 49.2% Republican and 49.1 Dem, I believe. Like within a point, sorry, it's a point different. 49.2 and 48.1 Dem. The 3rd, which is the seat Ron Kind's leaving, stays swingy, but it's 48.7 Dem, 40.3 Republican. So we knew that was going to be a race over there. That keeps it on the map for Democrats. Say, hey, we've got a shot. The 3rd. The 1st, what I'm watching is, can you find a candidate quickly? Can you get him or her with enough money to take on Stiles? Stiles got a pretty good bank account. I don't know, like, this is the fall to beat Brian Stiles in the 1st because it should be a good Republican year. It's still a swing district. Swing district, good GOP environment, come at a lot of money, tough to beat. But if it stays in place in 2024, presidential turnout,
oh yeah,
got
big
time
difference.
To find somebody, that could be the year to really go after Brian Stiles.
I thought we were going to keep going. Sorry there, Chair. Awkward pause. Mix this week, Brian Hagendorf, we touched on this on top of it. He is being quite the swing justice in liberal justices on the court.
He is the most important justice in terms of like big decisions, but he has no political allies right now. Skostats is a website that tracks Supreme Court stuff. In 19 4-3 decisions, he's the majority 16 times. Two of the conservative colleagues were in the majority 12 times of those decisions, but he is the one that kind of dictates where the court's going to go quite often. It's interesting, though, because he's elected as a conservative. The conservative base went to bat for him when he's being attacked in their minds about association with a Christian school and his values. They feel like he's turned on them. Brian, though, if you know him, he's kind of like a process conservative, the word's been used with me, that he believes in sticking to order. Like, he doesn't like original action of the Supreme Court. He likes to go lower courts first and come to us when the record is established. That's how it usually goes. The ruling about redistricting, we said least change, we're going to do least change. That's what we gave him, we're going to stick to it. And the interesting thing, too, is while he's the most important for the decisions, he's maybe the least influential with his colleagues because he can't get the conservatives to come where he wants them to go. And the liberals join him because they like the outcome sometimes, like the redistricting decision. I don't think Ann Walsh Bradley, Jill Karofsky, and Rebecca Dallet like least change. It was the best option on the table.
Right.
So they signed on to his ruling, that one.
And we talked a little bit of this on the show. Falling this week, we have Speaker Voss, you know, a lot of weight there with Gableman's report, a lot of the things that he's been openly talking about. And now we have the Republican Party trying to have this meeting on March 16th saying, hey, let's try to unite the party because there's a lot of efforts saying, hey, we don't like you and we don't like your leadership anymore.
Robin Voss is often the smartest person in the room in the Capitol.
Absolutely.
Everybody knows it. How he never saw this coming is baffling to people I talk to because he had to have known that you couldn't control Michael Gableman, that this outcome was inevitable. Either he would come back with a report saying, nothing to see here, let's just move on, or here are the problems, but let's not talk about decertification, which would have left the part of the base who wants to overturn results saying, well, he must be on the conspiracy because they didn't find what we know is going on. Or you have what happened, which is Gableman calling for decertification and have to keep talking about it. Robin got a primary opponent this week. Now, I don't know that this guy can raise money or give him a hard run. Robin, whatever you want to say about him, Madison is good at working his district back in the Burlington area. He's pretty rock solid there, but it takes away time and money. There are likely going to be primary challenges because Gableman dropped this report 3 months out from the filing deadline for assembly races. You could get people saying, well, you're not helping stop the steal, I'm going to get in. Again, I've not usually seen mass primary efforts be successful, but it's time and money away from the ultimate goal of winning in November. And Republicans keep looking back, not looking forward. They have a golden opportunity in front of them, and they're not going to get to focus on that unless they can change the dial, right? We're now until then. And this all goes back to Robin opened the door by bringing Gableman. Interesting post note. What's Gableman going to do next?
That's what I was just about to say. And will his contract, will Voss be pressured still, or will he just ultimately say, I'm not going to sign another contract? Are we still just going to be in this cloud of maybe there's a verbal contract, maybe there's not? I know Ted Basil's office this week said, no, we don't have anything. So
I'm talking about 2023.
So I know, but still.
Imagine this. Gableman was on the Supreme Court. There's an open seat next spring in the state Supreme Court. Dan Kelly is going to run as a conservative of the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
I had two people plant the seed to me this week that maybe Michael Gableman might want a run again for his old job.
Yeah.
So just capital gossip. Keep it in mind.
Yeah.
Watch, but
can't rule it out.
Gableman's not going away. And that's the other thing. He's not going away. He has a platform. He has a spotlight. He has a willing audience. He is going to stick around for a while and playing this out.
Yeah, and I think he's got a lot more name recognition than he did maybe even when he was on the court. Yeah. All right, that will do it for this week's Jam Pack Show. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Emily Fannin.
And I'm J.R. Ross.
Rewind. Your week in review is sponsored by the Wisconsin Realtors Association, bringing Wisconsin communities to life with great homes, businesses, and neighborhoods. The Wisconsin Realtors Association, the voice of real estate.